This is Craig Miller, Director of Star Wars Fan Relations, and you are inside the 12 months of Star Wars, only on Studio 2009.
Welcome to another GeekCast Radio Presents interview, this time for GeekCast Radio and Studio 2009. I am, of course, TFG and Mike. Joining me, as always, in the Studio 2009 12-month Star Wars series is Mr. Dave Draper. Hello, sir. How are you?
Hello. I'm all right. How are you?
Pretty good. Pretty good. Today, we have the most impressive opportunity to talk with Mr. Craig Miller, Director of Star Wars Fan Relations. Craig is much more than that, though. He is a film producer, advertiser, and writer. Hi, Craig. How are you?
I'm okay. How are you guys?
Pretty good. Pretty good.
Hanging in there?
Yep, yep. And we've got a lot of questions for Mr. Miller because we have read both of his books, Star Wars Memories and More Movie Memories. And, wow, I haven't read that much of, like, I read books, but I don't read the, that was like close to 1,000 pages. It's been a long time since I've read 1,000 pages, but it was awesome. Both of them were amazing, and we have a bunch of questions for you, and Dave's going to kick it off.
Okay. Yeah, well, first of all, because a lot of our readers might not have read those books yet, we're going to ask you about your background a little and how that got you into Lucasfilm and what the effect of being at Lucasfilm kind of had to set the trajectory of the rest of your, you know, career.
I'll take that as being the question.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, I was, this was 1976. I was just graduating from college. And I had been, all of my life, a big comic book, science fiction, movie, geek, fan, nerd. And through local science fiction fandom, I'd met Charlie Lippincott, who was, as you guys probably know, running Star Wars Corporation, which was the marketing, licensing, promotion side of Star Wars and Lucasfilm. And Charlie knew that there wasn't any good traditional way to market Star Wars. Science fiction, you know, today every other movie is science fiction or superheroes. Back in the 70s, people thought science fiction was stupid, it was for little kids, it wasn't anything serious people went to see. The actors in Star Wars were not famous. Mark, Carey, Harrison had, you know, at the very beginnings of their careers, they hadn't been stars of anything. And, you know, even Peter Cushing and Alec Guinness were thought of by Americans, if they were thought of at all, as being character actors in a lot of British detective and horror movies. So they weren't thought of as big stars. And the way you marketed in the 70s was you got interviews in magazines and you got your stars booked on talk shows like The Tonight Show. And no one was going to book Mark, Carey, or Harrison. So Charlie came up with the idea of marketing the film directly to the target audience, which is science fiction fans. He knew about fandom, but he was not part of fandom. And so we had met and as part of his explorations into fandom, and I ended up consulting with him that summer, 1976, on how to market Star Wars to fans. And we stayed in contact with my consulting through the next year. And after Star Wars came out and was a big hit, I was hired to come to Lucasfilm full time as part of the publicity team under the title of Director of Fan Relations.
Very cool, very cool. So just out of curiosity, because neither of us have been to a movie studio to watch a film at all in our lifetimes, but was there a difference in getting to watch the film at the studio it was made? Like that first time, you're first seeing the film, just seeing it at the studio. Was there a difference for you versus going to a movie theater and seeing a movie like that? Like, did it have more, was there more, quote unquote, privilege to it because it was a special thing?
Well, sure. Especially remember, I wasn't a jaded career film, you know, person, a filmmaker, whatever you want to call it. Mm-hmm. I had been to movie studios a couple of times, you know, but not in any official capacity. So just the whole experience of going to the studio, which was 20th Century Fox, and going into a screening room, and this was a screening room filled with people, and seeing Star Wars. I first saw it, I don't know exactly, 2-3 weeks before it opened. Even then, it wasn't quite completely finished, but, you mm-hmm. know, but it was as close to finished as, you know, there was nothing noticeably unfinished. And so it added excitement to the event, but, you know, I don't know that Star Wars would have needed anything extra to sell me, like so many people, but especially as someone who had a lifelong love of science fiction. That opening scene, you know, with the blockade runner and the Star Destroyer coming on screen. By the end of that scene, the movie had me. You know, it was just amazing.
Yeah, you mentioned in that chapter, my first viewing, you talked about how emotional your reaction was to seeing the completed film for the first time.
Yeah.
Was there any other moments at Lucasfilm that had kind of a similar impact?
Oh, gosh. You know, it. Yes and no. I mean, it's going to London and going on stage into the Ice Cave and seeing the full-size Millennium Falcon. And, you know, and the X-Wings and everything. That was from the, you know, the science fiction kid. It was just amazing. Between seeing that screening of Star Wars and going on to that stage was about 2 years. So I'd been on a lot of other movie lots and seen other things filming, but mm-hmm. you know, Star Wars had become such an important part of my life. And it was such an amazing, I mean, we all know it was an amazing film. So then to be on the stage with all of that stuff surrounding you, you know, that was just amazing. The first time I got to operate R2-D2.
Which was Sesame Street, right?
Which was, on Sesame Street. We did 5 segments that went into different episodes of Sesame Street. You know, getting to operate R2. Was terrific. I mean, who doesn't love R2?
Yeah, only heretics don't love R2 because yikes. And everyone makes fun of me for liking the scene in Revenge of the Sith. Is it Revenge or is it Attack? Whenever he starts flying, I'm like, ooh, yay, we get to actually see R2 doing stuff beyond the normal awesome stuff that he did in the original trilogy. I was like, R2 can fly. That's awesome. Everybody makes fun of me because I like that stuff. Oh, boy. This is what it is.
I was just going to quickly interject that mm-hmm. I know what you're saying because I got to go to Disney World last year. And at Galaxy's Edge, walking in and seeing the life-size Falcon was, you know, really kind of a big deal for a lifelong Star Wars fan.
Yeah, I mean, it would be, it should be, and they know that. That's why it's sitting there in the middle of a giant courtyard so you can get that full effect.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Good old Disney World. Gotta love it. So your books are filled with fascinating anecdotes and personal stories. Can you share any particular memorable or surprising experience that didn't make it into either of the books? Unless you're already working on a third book.
No, I'm not working on a third book like those. You know, there's between the two books, there's over 200,000 words, 800 some pages. Mm-hmm. That's an awful lot of stuff to remember. I don't know what story I could tell you that isn't part of that.
Yeah.
I mean, there, you know, obviously we all have things we do in our life. I went to the supermarket and I bought eggs.
Well, yeah. Yeah.
I tell stories that are that I hope are entertaining and are amusing or interesting, but there's a lot of what happens between all those stories that, you know, it may be Star Wars, but it was still going to work every day.
Right.
There was still deadlines to meet, and sometimes you have to deal with people who you don't care that much for or want to deal with, but, you know, work requires that. It's nice that I was working on something wonderful and magical, and for the most part, working with people I really liked.
Speaking of the people you worked with, like, you offer a lot of glimpses into how guys like George Lucas and Charles Lippincott worked. Was there any other insights or observations you can share about them or other notable figures you encountered at Lucasfilm?
Well, I worked with George, Charlie, of course, for the first year and a half was my direct boss until he left. Gary Kurtz, I worked with extensively. Gary became a good friend, and we worked together on a lot of movies over the next 40 years until he unfortunately passed away. But he was great. He was always surprising. Gary always came across as very serious and solemn, but he did have a joking, silly side to him. I tell that story about the impromptu prank we played on Mark Hamill in Star Wars Memories, which just surprised everyone. I mean, do you want me to tell that story?
No, people need to read the book. That was funny, but people need to read the book. When I was reading both books, and this is a side to what my next question is going to be, but when I was reading both of them, I'm like, this is why I love reading, because I'm reading somebody's story that I had never thought I would ever that's why I love autobiographies, because they're from a time that no one would really know. Like, none of us who are younger than you are, obviously, sir, and stuff like that. It's like, that is so cool. Like, listen, we'll get to the offices, but like all your office moves and stuff like that. I was like, oh, that is so cool. He got to do various things at each different location and everything else. And it's a nice look back in time. And I think everybody needs to read more autobiographies of people that are older than them, that people that had adventures and things from those 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, whatever, because it's a nice little snippet of history.
Well, and I also think it's interesting because, like, I'm a fan. I've been a fan since I was 76 years old. But, like, it's from a fan's perspective. You know, you were working at Lucasfilm, but you also went in as a fan. Whereas a lot of times, you know, there's the famous William Shatner get a life bit on Saturday Night Live. Because it was a job for these guys. Whereas you're a fan in the heart of something that fandom is like, oh my God, it had to be amazing, kind of, in a way.
Yeah, and you're absolutely right. It was. I mean, it was a job, but, you know, it's that saying, a kid in a candy store. I was there working, but I was doing stuff and associating with people and things I never dreamed I would do. I grew up in Los Angeles, but my family wasn't in the entertainment industry. I never thought I'd be in the entertainment industry. I didn't know I wasn't an actor. I didn't want to be a director. I didn't have any thought about, I'll end up in the movie business. You know, that was never part of my imagining. So it was, you know, amazing. It was dealing with people who I never thought I'd deal with, doing things, you know, flying to different countries and being on movie sets and locations and going to premieres and all that kind of stuff. You know, it's nice to have a job where you get to do cool, fun things. it wasn't only cool, fun things, but it's nice when you can sometimes do cool, fun things.
Yeah, absolutely. You provide a detailed account of the challenges in securing studio approval for Star Wars, including the role of market research. In your opinion, how has the film industry's approach to market research and audience feedback evolved since when you were doing it?
Okay, well, I never did the market research, but Fox had a market research department, and I'm sure studios still do, and they make sense. But, you know, as I mentioned in the book, one of my degrees is in social psychology. Social psychology is in part things like market research and testing and studying opinion, polling, all that kind of stuff. The people at Fox did that mostly valid research, but they asked the wrong people the wrong questions. You know, it's the way they tested movies, not the part where they show it to them and, you know, mm-hmm. say, what did you think of it? But the sort of advanced testing they do. What they did on Star Wars was primarily two things. Here's a list of types of movies: comedy, drama, war, Western, mystery, romance. Science fiction was on the list. They asked people, you know, which of these are you most interested in? Which of these are you least interested in? They also give them lists of titles. What does this title suggest to you? Does this title sound interesting to you? Like it'd be a movie you'd want to see? Mm-hmm. Those are valid questions to ask, but they are limited in scope. Plus, what they did is they went out to Hollywood Boulevard, which in L.A., even back in the 70s, was a sort of mid-level street with many movie theaters, but not huge amounts of traffic.
Mm-hmm.
And they asked them these questions in the middle of the afternoon. Well, these were not people who were likely to go see a science fiction movie. So when they asked them those questions, science fiction was one of the bottom two or three types of movies people wanted to see. And no one understood what Star Wars as a title meant. Science fiction wasn't a thing. We were still in Vietnam. You hear Star Wars, people were going, I don't know what that is. Is it about Vietnam? Is it about movie stars in Vietnam? They didn't know what was going on. So it's not really bad. Market research is bad. It's just it wasn't handled well. You can do good market research, but it has to be done carefully and thoughtfully. You know, the advice Fox got was, don't make a science fiction movie. And if you do make this movie, change the title. No one will go see a movie called Star Wars.
Well, and the whole industry kind of was changing at that time, too, wasn't it? Because Jaws, you know, was the first summer blockbuster. And Jaws was the first film that said, hey, these teenagers, they got a lot of money. They want something to do during the summer. And Star Wars, you know, sort of came along and cemented that. But it was, you know, the industry was changing and who was going to see movies was changing.
Yeah, to a
great extent. They hadn't caught up yet.
Yeah, to a great extent, that's true. Jaws was absolutely the first big blockbuster. Summer was thought of as a time that kids went to movies, adults didn't go to movies, adults went on vacation. You know, wasn't a good time to release movies. So Jaws, then Star Wars, and then really from Star Wars, a lot of places said, okay, the movie industry will take one instance and say, this is a trend, and go that direction.
Yep.
And, you know, it's like Star Wars opened in the end of May, which was before the previously held thought of as to when summer started. Now summer is starting in the beginning of May with movie releases. And yeah, absolutely. It's also not thought of necessarily as just kids, but people want to see something exciting, something, you know, adventurous, something that'll take them out of their normal day to day. You know,
I mean, Star Wars was very groundbreaking like that. And is there anything that you're working on now that you might you can see anything like you've heard of or like anything in the horizon that might ever have that kind of effect again?
You know, it's
40 years from now, everyone's talking about this movie.
It's so hard to predict anything like that. I mean, when we were doing Star Wars, the thought was, we think this movie will be successful, which means it'll make enough money that we'll be able to make a sequel. Maybe a low budget sequel, but that was as far as success was taking us, being able to make a sequel. Real success would be a full budget sequel.
Yeah.
You know, Alan Dean Foster's Splinter in the Mind's Eye, first Star Wars novel, was written with the idea that it could be the low budget sequel. Fewer locations, fewer characters, that kind of thing.
Luke and Leia weren't siblings yet.
a lot of things hadn't happened yet.
Yeah. Well, there's a moment in that book where, they weren't siblings yet.
No. Well, I mean, it wouldn't necessarily have followed the book exactly, but...
No. Well, I mean, famously, like, one of the interesting things about the writing process is how, like, people think that just because you've got an idea, it's written in stone the whole way through. And, in fact, you bring this up, that, like, Lucas himself told you that he was changing his plans after Return of the Jedi. It's like... People think that because Lucas had a plan, it was the plan, and he never changed anything. The original script was Leia was the hero rescuing Luke, and Han was a weird alien, and stuff is very fluid until it's actually, like, in front of you.
Yeah, I mean, things change. There's a lot of mythos around the origins of Star Wars, some of which were fostered by George, but... that aren't really accurate. Did he have an idea for many more movies? Yes. Was it exactly like this? No. Lots of stuff changed over time.
Yeah. That's what happens. Time changes everything.
Yeah.
All right. So I've got two little small questions here because I have been over my lifetime moving various places and I usually use my living room as my office for the most part. So you've had many different office spaces in your career. Which was the best and worst location for your work style? Or did you adapt to where you were working out of?
Oh, you always adapt. Nothing's forever, and you go with what are required. When I started at Lucasfilm originally was in an office in Universal Studios, on the Universal Studios lot. Mm-hmm. And we kept that office for many years, but the company quickly outgrew it. So when I joined, while the company still had that office, the publicity and licensing side of things were working in an office about, I don't know, half a mile or so, a mile away off the lot. We were in a doctor's medical suite in a small building, all doctor's offices. Mm-hmm. And my first desk was in the reception area. We had a receptionist who at the time was Mick Garris, who's gone on to a great career as a director. But Mick was our receptionist. I had another office or another desk in the reception area just because that was the only place available.
Right.
Charlie had the doctor's office as his office. And, you know, we had a couple of other people in different what would have been exam rooms if there were still doctors there. Mm. And after, you know, a month or two, my duties expanded, and I was given one of the exam rooms for my office because I had more needs than just a desk. And I was having people in for meetings and stuff. And so it changes. And we were there for, I don't know, a year, and then we moved to... we got rid of that building or that office, and we moved into offices. Universal had taken over. There was a motel across the street from Universal Studios. Big motel, two stories, lots of wings. But, you know, it was probably 100 rooms, maybe, something like that. They had taken over that and converted them to offices. And so we moved into the motel, and we all had we had a row of offices in the motel. You know, it was interesting because now, because they all used to be sleeping rooms, like in a motel or hotel, we all had our own private bathroom.
That's right.
You know, and eventually we moved into, we bought the, we bought a building, the Olsen Brothers Egg Farm, which was rebuilt and converted into the Lucasfilm building, which we called the Egg Company. And for a while, we moved into office trailers in the parking lot of the Egg Company while the final stages of the remodeling was going on. Then we moved into the Egg Company building.
Did you ever have your ultimate geek out office space besides what you currently have at home?
Yeah, boy. Well, I you know, I don't know what you mean geek out. All my offices are surrounded by, are filled with stuff I love.
Mm-hmm.
Artwork and posters.
I tell
a story in the book when we were in the Egg Company, where they had a decorator who was going from office to office decorating it for people. And I got tired because we had a lot of offices, and I finally just hung stuff up in my office because I didn't want empty walls.
Yep.
Until they got around to my office, and then when we changed it, when they did get to my office, they looked around and said, "This is great. Just keep this stuff." But one of the things I had was I'm a huge fan of George's first picture, THX 1138.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a special poster done for it. Heavy foil, you know, full-size movie poster, but done on a heavy foil. And it's just a headshot of one of the chrome robots from the movie. And it says THX 1138, and that's all it says on it. And I had managed, I won't go into the whole story, it's in the book, but
yeah,
I managed to get literally the last 10 existing of those posters from the printer. Because I wanted one of those print posters, and so I tracked down where they got printed, and they said, if you take all of them, we'll give you one. and so I did, and so I had one framed, and I put it up in my office. And George came into my office one day and just stared at that poster, and he said, "Where did you get that poster? I don't have one of those." And I said, it's my favorite poster. I love it. I love the movie. But I have a duplicate if you want one. And I got out one of my duplicates, and I sent it up to George up in Marin. And it's now, and it's been hanging up in the Lucasfilm offices ever since. It's moved around a couple of times. It was in the library. It's been in the hanging in the archives. But, you know, so having my posters and artwork around and photographs has always been something I've done wherever I've had offices.
Yeah.
That's my favorite story from the book about the poster. So as the director of fan relations, you had a pretty, you know, firsthand perspective of the early fan community. How did you navigate those challenges and rewards of managing a non-existent to a rabidly passionate fan base?
Well, I guess it helped that I was already connected to fandom, part of fandom, and to some extent known in fandom because I was involved with like putting on conventions and stuff. A lot of people knew of me or knew me. So I wasn't this I was going to say some weird guy. I was a weird guy,
oh,
but I was.
I am no, that weird I was guy. Weird,
I was one of our weird guys. But I wasn't someone in an office in a suit somewhere. You know, I was part of fandom, and so I could deal with people knowing where they're coming from, knowing how they're feeling, because I was part of that. I was one of them. And I always approach things with explanations if necessary, you know. I mean, there isn't an explanation necessary for, hey, we're starting the official Star Wars fan club. But there's an explanation necessary when people want to produce their own merchandise and sell it. And we have to tell them, no, you can't do that.
Yeah.
And, you know, and it's, I'll tell you a story from, this was the 1978 World Science Fiction Convention.
Mm-hmm.
We were there, I was there representing Lucasfilm and Star Wars. We didn't have anything new to show, not in the summer of 78, but we set up in the exhibit hall with a small rear screen projection setup, showing a lot of production art and foreign movie posters and stuff. And I had a prototype of Kenner's radio control R2-D2, which is, you know, about, I don't know, 10 inches high or something.
Mm-hmm.
And was just about as functional as our real R2 was at that time. He could go forward. He could go forward and back. He could turn left and right, and you could spin his head around. And that was all the real R2 could do. But anyway, I was there in the exhibit hall showing that. Unbeknownst to me, the FBI showed up at that Worldcon. The FBI has a big office in the Worldcon was in Phoenix that year, and the FBI has a big office in Phoenix, or used to, I don't know if it still does, because a lot of East Coast mobsters would retire to Arizona.
Yep.
So they wanted to keep an eye on them. And so, you know, the FBI has a copyright squad that deals with copyright and trademark violation and stuff like that. They're not, you know, they're not going through magazines and saying, oh, you've got your copyright wrong. Mm-hmm. But they're like seizing counterfeit merchandise.
Yeah.
Fake Prada bags and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And they showed up for reasons I don't know at the convention. And they had identified themselves to the convention committee. And the convention committee brought the head of the squad over to meet me because I was there from Lucasfilm.
Right.
And one of the things they were going to do was go through the exhibit hall looking at dealers selling bootleg merchandise.
Oh, wow. Dang.
Not something we had requested and not the sort of thing we did.
Yeah, no.
But so we talked and I said, look, yeah, there are definitely people here who are in the bootleg merchandise business. And there are some people here who are just fans doing one little thing. And we want to, you know, treat them accordingly. I can't, you know, obviously I can't give orders to the FBI.
Obviously.
But I told them how we would like them to proceed.
Yeah.
So like there were, for example, there was one young woman who had a dealer's table, and among the things she was selling is she had done some Star Wars artwork and printed it up on notepads. And they told her, take these off your table, don't sell them while we're here, and just sell out of them. Just don't keep printing more.
Right.
Other people who were like, who were clearly in the, we're making, here are 36 different buttons and 8x10 photos and, you know, yada, 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 spread out on 3 dealer's room tables. You know, they were in the business of bootlegging.
Yes.
From them, they actually seized all their merchandise and gave them some kind of written notice about violations and yada, you know, and all that kind of stuff. the young woman I spoke to afterwards, she came up to me because, you know, I was obviously there from Lucasfilm, being in the Lucasfilm booth.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to her, and she said to me, you know, I don't have any money. You can't sue me and get money. I said, we don't want to do anything, but we're not looking for money from you. We don't care about that. The point is that the law is written so that if we don't stop every instance of trademark violation that we become aware of, we can lose the trademark. If you don't enforce your trademark, you lose it. You no longer have to the big company that, you know, wants to produce, say, a line of action figures. You can't do that. We have the trademark, and Kenner, these days Mattel.
Hasbro,
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
God, shoot me in the head.
No, it's okay.
Hasbro has the only license to produce those. You have to enforce it. So that's why they're telling you, don't sell anymore. It's not that we're afraid you're making money. It's that you can cause us to lose the trademark.
Yeah.
And so we have to do that. You also, you know, you don't have to go out of your way to find every violation.
That's true.
And so that was the position I took. We don't have to go out of our way to find every violation. We didn't want to stomp on fans' enthusiasm.
Yeah.
We just had to have them be aware of what we needed in order to help them celebrate Star Wars, because we all love Star Wars.
Yeah, absolutely. In the books, you share insights into Lucasfilm's early convention appearances. How did fan interactions in those days shape your approach to fan relations and marketing?
You know, everything you do, you learn something new. You hear from people, you hear what they want. I mean, marketing is really answering needs. It's, you know, people, if you want to sell something, you hear what people want to buy, and that's what you sell them. If people want to be enthusiastic about something you've done, you support them in that enthusiasm. And that's what I tried to do, what we tried to do within the scope and limitations of what we could do. We did things like in 1976, we did a small display at the World Science Fiction Convention of props and photos and artwork and costumes from Star Wars. The 1979 World Science Fiction Convention happened to be in England, in Brighton, while we were still shooting Empire. And so we went over and we set up, not big compared to, say, a display at a museum, but a much bigger display in the hotel the World Science Fiction Convention was happening in Brighton that year. Costumes, photos, and aquari artwork.
Isn't that where you had like an actual snow speeder in the lobby?
Yep. Right. We brought a full-size snow speeder and set that up. It was in the sort of this concourse that led to the exhibit hall. So before you went into the exhibit hall, which is the dealers and the art show and all that, you had to walk by this full-size snow speeder, and there was a sign on it saying, come see the Empire Strikes Back exhibit in whatever the name of the room was upstairs. And that directed people up to our big exhibit.
Very cool.
Because we wanted to share it with everybody. Yes, it's mercenary in that we want people to know and be excited and go and buy tickets. But it's also because we cared about, you know, fandom. One of the reasons we ran the fan club in-house, the official Star Wars fan club, is I went and met with people who were in the business of running fan clubs for mostly like rock groups and, you know, things like that. some movie star, TV stars, about, you know, celebrity and other types of fan clubs. And I just didn't like the way they operated. They were much more mercenary. When you joined, you got a really poor quality membership kit. You know, you would get a badly printed, like an offset printed photo, not a real photo. You know, that kind of thing, that kind of quality level. And mostly what they were doing was harvesting addresses to send ads to buy merchandise.
Yep.
Not what we were looking for at all. We wanted something that would keep people's excitement up. The fan club wasn't a direct money-making operation. We lost money on the fan club. Yes, it was to keep people excited about Star Wars between movies, but it was to keep people excited about Star Wars. And we operated as, what would I want if I were joining the Star Wars fan club? And we just took that attitude towards everything. And the more you associate with your fan base, the more you know what they want and how to please them.
One of the stories that I like that you tell in the book is how, like, if Mark got mail, it went to Mark. And if Carrie got mail, it went to Carrie. But if Darth Vader got mail, you know, and there's a great story, I think, in the second book about how, like, you were at a convention somewhat recently and people found out that you were the guy signing Darth Vader's autograph. And suddenly everybody wanted your autograph, like, well, the guy who signed Darth Vader.
Yeah, well, I was appearing, you know, and much to my surprise, people want my autograph, because I think of, oh, you get movie stars autographs and baseball player autographs, not behind the scenes people autographs. But people ask me for autographs frequently, but they were asking me to sign both my name and Darth Vader.
That's awesome.
So, I was 6 when Star Wars came out, and generally I do these podcasts and a lot of stuff with people who are younger than me, like Mike.
Sorry.
They always kind of roll their eyes because I'm a big Star Wars fan. I've been since I was a child. And I always talk about how everything changed. Everything was different after Star Wars, and they always like, yeah, yeah, old man, Star Wars changed everything. But I think it did have an undeniable and lasting impact on popular culture. So in your view, what were the key factors that contributed to the franchise's appeal, its staying power, and its ability to connect with, like, generations of fans?
Well, you know, Star Wars is amazing. There's really been nothing like it before. If you look at movies before Star Wars, in the decade or so before Star Wars, they were serious, slice of culture, you know, day in the life, deep philosophical, meaningful things. The negative reviews Star Wars got, and it did get a bunch of them, was it was just fluff. It wasn't serious. It didn't add to the human condition, that kind of stuff. But what it showed was that people, as much as people are concerned with the human condition, they also want excitement and they want to have fun. And just the success of Star Wars suddenly meant maybe we should be making other types of movies that are more freewheeling, more 30s, 40s kind of movies.
More fun.
Yeah. And, you know, and there was fandom beforehand. There was even fandom for individual things, not so much a movie, but Star Trek had a huge ongoing fandom long after.
Well, it had gone into what's it called? In the 70s, it was, what do you call that when you redistribute the old films, old things? I can't remember. Syndication. It had gone into syndication in the 70s and had and that's when it really blew up.
Well, there was a big Star Trek fandom throughout the 60s and into the 70s, and then the show in syndication helped expand that.
Yeah.
and it grew. And so Star Trek had that ongoing fandom. It became much more universal with Star Wars, having a big fandom and that joint kind of experience, because science fiction was really still kind of weird in the 60s. You know, people who like science fiction were strange. Star Wars went from, oh, it's science fiction, I'm not interested, to, I'm not interested in science fiction, but I like Star Wars. You know, it slowly expanded as more and more things fell into that. Oh, yeah, but I like this. It became science fiction was cool. They still treated a lot of us as nerds. But,
yeah, I was going to say, it wasn't really that cool, but I think it was acceptable. It eventually became the mainstream.
Right, exactly. The fans weren't cool. The thing was cool. But, you know, and so it just... And it had just this huge effect of, I mean, the types of movies that were being made completely changed. Yep. because of the success of Star Wars. People were seeing what they wanted. And Star Wars got made to a great extent because George and Gary Kurtz were working on the edit of American Graffiti, the film they had made together before Star Wars. And they wanted to take a break. And so they were looking in a newspaper they were going to go see a movie and get away from American Graffiti and just relax for an evening. And that's what we used to do in the old days, is we'd look in a newspaper to see what movies were playing.
That's right.
And they couldn't see any movies they wanted to see. They wanted something fun and exciting. And everything was, you know, Easy Rider or,
Deer Hunter or Godfather.
Well, even not as, you know, stuff that was more psychological and, you know, that kind of thing. And they said, you know, okay, when we finish American Graffiti, we got to make the kind of movie we want to go see. Yeah. And that ended up being Star Wars. They just didn't realize how many people wanted to go see that kind of movie.
Nope. So getting into some more movie memories and the writing life, more movie memories is the sequel to your previous book. How did the process of revisiting your memories differ this time around with the sequel compared to Star Wars memories?
Well, it was a couple of different things. One is I'd already written a book. It had come out and people liked it, which is always very nice. You never know if that's going to happen or not.
Right.
And a lot of people encouraged me to do another book and tell stories about all the stuff I worked on after Star Wars. I'm very good at marketing other things. I'm not very good at marketing myself, so I feel a little embarrassed when I say things like, a lot of the reviews that the book got, the first book, Star Wars Memories, was that my writing style is very accessible and it feels like we're having a conversation rather than you're reading a textbook.
Yeah, I get that.
It's a very friendly, open sort of style, which is very nice to hear. And it gave me, okay, so I will keep doing that with this other stuff. And so I would, at first, it was going to be mainly about the other movies I worked on throughout the 80s after I left Lucasfilm.
Mm-hmm.
But during COVID, which happened almost immediately after we first released Star Wars Memories, one of the things I did is I went through all my old file cabinets to see what I didn't need to keep anymore. Because, you know, stuff goes into a file cabinet and it never comes out again.
Right.
And so I found a bunch of stuff that I didn't know I still had. Things like the More Movie Memories. Now, the final book has about one third of it is additional Star Wars stories because I found stuff I didn't remember still having, like right. all the stuff about the rap party for Empire Strikes Back with the invitation and photos of how they set up the party on the Dagobah stage in the middle of the Dagobah set, photos of the cake and we had, which was in the shape of the patch, the crew patch from Empire, stuff like that. You know, so there was a lot of memories. It's not that they were, oh, these were the Star Wars memories that weren't good enough for the first book.
Right.
These are just stuff I hadn't quite remembered.
Yep.
Or didn't have enough material on to actually feel I could actually write about them.
Yeah.
So about a third of the book is more Star Wars. The next third is about lots of the movies I worked on. Superman 2, Altered States, Excalibur, John Carpenter's The Thing, Last Starfighter, The Muppets Take Manhattan, Dark Crystal. You know, lots and lots of different movies for Jim Henson, Disney, Universal, Warner Brothers, other companies. And then the last third of the book is I left movie marketing and became a writer, primarily of animation. And it talks about working in that industry, in that field, or that part of the entertainment industry. My experiences trying to write for Star Trek and creating my own show called Pocket Dragon Adventures. We did 104 episodes and played in over 100 countries around the world. We working on, you know, G.I. Joe and Beast Wars and all kinds of animated shows. So it's just memories and stories about all these different things I've done in the nearing 50 years I've been working in the entertainment industry.
I've got some ElfQuest super fans in my friend circle. And so I was telling them the story about that, and they were all kind of like, oh, well, one of them already knew everything because he's like that. But how you almost did the ElfQuest show and didn't happen.
Yeah, I mean, there's a bunch of stories in there about things that didn't happen because I could tell you, oh, well, I was hired to develop this show. And so I came up with a concept and then we wrote a bunch of episodes. And, you know, that's kind of interesting, and I could tell it in a sort of interesting way, but there are only so many times that that's an interesting story. The story is about things you worked on and you did, and then for one reason or another didn't happen or didn't happen the way you had hoped. Those are actually more interesting and more informative stories. So there's a mixture of successes and, I don't like the word failures, but not successes.
Hey, you got paid. That's all that matters.
Yeah.
And it's funny because, like, you know, obviously the first book was an easy sell for me because, like, I'm a Star Wars super fan. And then I looked into the second book and I was like, you know, like you said, The Thing and Altered States and Superman 2 and Dark Crystal and Baby, Secret of the Lost Legend, a movie that I thought I was the only one that remembered. Like, I saw that in the theaters because I'm also a huge dinosaur nut. Like, I was like, oh my God, this guy worked on my childhood. Like all these movies that were such a big thing for me. How do you think that your Lucasfilm experience helped you working with all these other films?
Well, of course it helped. I left Lucasfilm right after we opened Empire Strikes Back for a couple of reasons. One is that George had told me that he was going to be closing the LA operation down and moving us or some of us, up to Marin and keeping Lucasfilm all up there. And he also told me that he was going to make one more Star Wars movie and then stop making, you know, commercial movies. Well, the first one of those happened. The second one didn't quite go that way. But it still meant moving from L.A., where I had grown up, to the Bay Area, and if I wanted to stay in the movie business, 3 years later, I'd have to move back because George wasn't going to make any more movies, and there wasn't a movie business up there. So I decided I wasn't gonna move, but I decided to leave the company because coming off the effect of Star Wars and Empire Strikes Back, that's a pretty good pedigree when you try to go and find another job.
Oh yeah,
yeah.
And in my case, I wasn't looking for another job. I had decided to become an independent consultant to studios. And in the same way, saying, well, my previous work was Star Wars and Empire Strikes Back. Do you want me to help you market your movie?
That's the way to do it.
Not a hard sell.
No.
So I left very shortly after we opened Empire and set up an office, and almost immediately had a contract with Warner Brothers to help them market Superman II, Altered States, Excalibur. Those were the main ones. Also, The Hand, Outland, you know. So I was employed almost immediately at double what I was making at nearly double what I was making at Lucasfilm. Consultants get paid a lot better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I went on for another 10 years representing, studios. Like I said, Jim Henson, Warner Brothers, Disney, lots of places. It was a good time. It was a good career. But then the industry changed. Both the industry changed and I changed, but the industry changed as I wasn't working with filmmakers anymore,
mm-hmm.
who used to be running studios. I was working with attorneys and MBAs who I was spending more time in meetings than actually doing the work that I was being hired to do.
Right. Yeah.
And it became less fun to do.
Yeah.
Work jobs aren't necessarily fun, but if you have the option of it being fun, take the job that's fun.
Absolutely.
And I also found I wanted to do something more directly creative, and writing seemed to be a good way to go for me based on my interests and skills. And animation was the first door that opened, and so I ended up doing mostly animation for the next going on 40 years.
Yeah. Dave mentioned the episode that he had rewatched. I rewatched The Probe from Beast Wars. I love that episode.
Oh yeah, that was fun.
Yeah.
Beast Wars. I worked on the first season of it, and I just wrote the one episode with my then writing partner Marv Wolfman.
Yep.
Is that all? Just Marv Wolfman, just comics legend, that's all.
Yeah, well, comics legend. Marv is a very close friend, still is. We see each other all the time. And for several years, we worked together as writing partners. We co-created and co-produced the Pocket Dragon Adventures series I mentioned.
Mm-hmm.
They hired us to write an episode of Beast Wars. And one of the problems with Beast Wars, at least that first season, because computer-generated animation, CGI, was so new and so expensive and so complicated, they basically built most of the assets at the beginning of the season, and that was pretty much what you had to work with for the whole season. So we had six good guy characters, six bad guy characters, and props. And, you know, there were no other characters. There were no people, no, mm-hmm. none of that stuff. So the hard part was coming up with reasons for there to be a story. A lot of the episodes ended up being, oh, look, there's one of the other guys. Let's fight. And I wanted to have, and Marv wanted to have, something more meaningful. And so we came up with this idea for that episode, The Probe, which was briefly the rest of the good guys had sent satellites, probes, out through the galaxy looking for their missing comrades.
Yep.
And if they, you know, sending out a beacon saying, hey, where are you? Let us know. We'll come get you.
Mm-hmm.
And for reasons that made sense within the universe of Beast Wars, they couldn't send a signal directly from the planet's surface. They had to build a big tower to get it up high enough to get through a layer of stuff that kept the signal from getting out. And so now the bad guys didn't want hundreds of good guys to come and capture them. So they didn't want the probe contacted. And so now there was at least a reason, a goal for our good guys to achieve and something for the bad guys to make an effort to stop.
Yep. Yeah, it was a fun episode. Very fun. You, it's funny because this is going to be the next episode of the podcast in episode 109. Dave and I already recorded it. We are going to talk about the holiday and Lego holiday special, but you debunked a myth about the Star Wars holiday special airing only once. How do you think this misconception persisted for so long?
I really don't know, because up until a couple years ago, I thought it had aired only once in the U.S. or anywhere. I was under the same misconception. But a fan in Australia did the research and went through the newspaper TV listings and found that for 2 or 3 years, it kept running in the holiday season in Australia. Because you could see the listings. It was there.
Yeah.
I think that's the answer, Mike. It was Australia. I mean, first of all, like, if you weren't around in 1978, I've watched shows about the holiday special where people talk about it like it was a myth. Like, I never knew. It was like it's Bigfoot. I didn't know it was true. I mean, now because it's on the internet, it's on YouTube, everybody knows about it, and it's a thing. But there was a period of time where it was a videotape that was passed around at conventions, and it had a there were people that didn't know it existed at all, let alone that it aired 3 times in Australia. I mean, it's Australia. It's the side of the world.
Well,
it's 1978.
The question is, and I don't have an answer for it, did it air in any other countries multiple times? You know, the network in the U.S. was willing not to air it anymore because it didn't get a good reaction. But it isn't uncommon for international distribution to include X number of airings.
Yes.
And so it very well may have run in England or France or Germany or wherever, you know, 2 or 3 more times than we're aware of. I don't actually know how many countries it ever aired in. So it was, but yeah, it was interesting to find out that it really wasn't a one time only in the U.S. and never again anywhere.
You mentioned that you worked on Muppets Take Manhattan.
Yeah.
And what was your favorite part? And if you had to pick one, who was your favorite Muppet?
I guess my favorite has to be Kermit, you know. Mm. I just kind of relate to Kermit being in the middle of all, trying to make order out of all the chaos.
yeah.
And but having a good time and trying to stay even tempered and throughout it all. You know, my favorite part really was getting to know Jim Henson and working with him. I actually started working with him on Dark Crystal. Gary Kurtz was the producer on Dark Crystal, and he asked me to come and work on the film. And I got to know Jim working on that. And Jim asked me to stay because they were starting Muppets Take Manhattan right away. And Jim was just an amazing guy. He was everything you want Jim Henson to have been. He was by far the nicest guy I have ever worked with. Immensely talented. Very open, very friendly, and he was just terrific.
Yeah, every time I see, because I do doom scrolling on YouTube Shorts and Instagram Reels and things like that now on social media when I don't want to do anything or when I want to turn my brain off and just not think about the real world. So when I doom scroll through some of these social media platforms and I run across clips of Jim on the old, like, David Letterman or Johnny Carson or something, and it's so fun seeing him talk about the whole thing, but then immediately if Johnny or Dave or whoever says, hey, who can you bring Rolf out or can you do this? Like, literally, the clip of him on Letterman with Rolf is like, Dave asks him, and then he says, oh, yeah, sure. But, like, the yeah, sure part of it is, like, in Rolf's voice as he's I'm like, oh, my God, this guy is so cool. So fun.
In 1983...
Mm-hmm.
The World Science Fiction Convention that year was in Baltimore, Maryland. And there's a touring museum exhibit, The Art of the Muppets. And we set up in the lobby of the Baltimore Convention Center, where the convention was taking place, a partial version of that Art of the Muppets exhibit. And in the glass cases were, you know, Kermit and Piggy, and because of what we were doing, there were Dark Crystal characters like a Skeksis and Agra, you know, stuff like that. And so we had this big exhibit set up, and Jim came to the convention, and when I set up on the convention's program, he did one big talk in the convention's main hall for, I don't know, a couple thousand people, where, you know, he talked and he answered questions and he did some stuff with the characters. But then a little later that day, Jim came down to the lobby where we had the Art of the Muppets exhibit, and we had scheduled an event that was kids only. It was for anyone 12 and under, I think, but the kids who were at the convention, mostly with their parents. The parents or anyone else could stand around the perimeter of the lobby. But in the lobby, there was in front of the glass cases, was one chair that Jim sat on, and the kids were all sitting on the floor. And this was something he wanted to do. He wanted to do a thing for the kids who were there. And it was just him talking and answering questions. And he brought out Kermit and he, you know, did Kermit for the kids. And, you know, and if you've ever seen him doing these, even on TV, suddenly you're talking to Kermit. You're not talking to the guy holding a green glove on his hand. You're talking to Kermit. And I mean, that was going on, and it was just this amazing event that was something that he just wanted to do, you know, just to let the kids get close to Kermit and some of the other characters. And that was just the kind of guy he was.
So transitioning from marketing to writing, some might say that's a bold move. What inspired the shift and what challenges did you face?
Well, I think I've already answered part of that question. Mm-hmm. You know, the industry changed. I wanted to do something. I wanted to get out of the marketing consultant business and into something more creative. And writing was an opportunity. You know, the challenges you face is you have to prove yourself. Doesn't matter how many people you know. It doesn't matter if you're somebody's son, which I'm not, you know, I didn't have any family I could use to get in. The only thing I had going for me is I'd been in the industry for a while. So there were people I could, who I knew well enough to call up and ask for a meeting. You know, that's absolutely an advantage, but that only gets you so far.
Right.
You still have to have material to prove yourself. Mm-hmm. Because no one is going, oh, he's my friend, we'll pay him all this money, and then they'll have to write the script for no money because you're not able to do it. So I was able, my friend Joe Straczynski, better known as J. Michael Straczynski, he later created Babylon 5, among other things, but Joe was working in animation, and he'd just been hired to be the story editor, the showrunner on the animated version of Ghostbusters called The Real Ghostbusters.
Mm-hmm.
And back then, we had the the original syndication market, where they would order animated shows. They'd order 65 episodes, which would play 5 days a week for 13 weeks, and then they'd cycle through them again. But they would order 65 was, you know, the right number for that 13-week span. But when you're doing 65 episodes, you have a short time schedule to get them done. You need a lot of writers. So it was a lot easier for new writers to get in than it is today when orders are much shorter and there isn't a syndication market like that. But back then there was. And so Joe had some writers he went to immediately who he knew would be able to deliver. But he was willing to take a meeting with me, and I pitched him some ideas along with my writing partner at that time, somebody much less famous, named Mark Nelson. But we pitched him some ideas, and he liked one of them. He gave us a chance. He hired us to, we wrote the outline. The outline got approved. We wrote the script and ended up writing 3 episodes for the first season of The Real Ghostbusters before moving on to another series called The Bionic Six at a different studio, where it did 10 episodes of their 65-episode order. Mm-hmm. And have stayed writing ever since. I write, I develop shows for companies. I do a lot of, I'm a story editor, showrunner on a lot mm-hmm. of animated shows. I work on a lot of shows for companies overseas. I've done shows in China, Italy, France, Israel. I developed a show for Israel. I did shows, 2 series for the Middle East for a streaming channel out of Dubai. So a lot of international work, and I'm theoretically going to be starting a screenplay, an adaptation for a Japanese producer once the contracts get worked out.
Very cool.
So you mentioned just now that you worked for like Ghostbusters and we've talked about G.I. Joe and Transformers, but you've also worked on, like you mentioned, Bionic Six, which like yeah. I actually have some of those toys.
Oh, so those are rare.
How do you approach writing? Like I remember your story about how you can't even find them on video, or you can't get them, can't find the collections of those. Like there are a couple of series you worked on where they never preserve them. But how do you approach writing?
Finish up.
Just how do you approach writing for different audiences? And like, do you go in with like a different approach for like something that's known, like Ghostbusters or G.I. Joe, and something that's less known, like Bionic Six was at the time? Or
it's a mixture, because assuming you're coming on to a show as opposed to developing it, on The Real Ghostbusters, there were personalities, there were rules. Every show has what's called a show Bible that tells you who the main characters are, who any recurring characters are, places, you know, props. Like in The Real Ghostbusters, it's the Ecto-Mobile and the proton packs and, you know, that and the ghost traps, that sort of thing. That doesn't mean you're necessarily restricted to those things. You might be, it depends on the show, because other shows have more freedom and you can invent new things. But you have to stay, the biggest thing is it's a TV series. You have to stay true to the characters. Whether it's an existing thing where, like Ghostbusters, where people are familiar with it from the movies, or it's original to the TV show, so you just have to stay true to the show concept. Because the characters have to be the same from episode to episode. You know, it's in Indiana Jones, he can't be afraid of snakes in Raiders and not afraid of snakes in Temple of Doom. You know?
Yeah.
the characteristics have to stay the same. So you have to be cognizant of what the rules are for it and what the rules are that you can break. In real Ghostbusters, one of the rules was nothing from outer space. It's all ghosts and spirits and nothing with aliens and nothing out in space. But then I was given the challenge by Joe, who was the showrunner, to come up with something that involved aliens and outer space that fit within the show. And so that was the third episode we did called Ain't Necessarily So, which deliberately violated that rule, but still keeping it within the framework of the rest of the rules of the series. So, I mean, you always have to be cognizant of what the setup is. You're playing in someone else's sandbox. You got to keep the sand inside and you don't bring sand from another sandbox. You need to be inventive. One of the reasons you hire writers, when we did Pocket Dragon Adventures, we did 104 episodes. Marv and I wrote 2 episodes together. We each wrote about 25 episodes individually, and the rest of the episodes, which was like 50 episodes, we hired other people to do, both for reasons of scheduling. You can only write so much at a time, also, you know, you sort of burn out on ideas for characters, and people who are fresh to the characters come up with things you might not have thought of, or you might have thought of them if you hadn't already thought of 50 other stories.
That's very true.
So that's why you bring in other people for their ideas, but they have to be ideas that stay within the scope of the sandbox.
Yep. Absolutely. All right, we got just 2 more questions until the ad break. We are only 3 short years away from Star Wars being 50 years old. You experienced it at its inception. After all this time, what does its legacy mean to you?
It means I'm very old and tired.
Stop it.
Stop. I hear that.
God, you know, it's what does its legacy mean to me? Star Wars has, to a great extent, shaped my life. You know, I wouldn't be in the movie industry or the entertainment industry without it, or unlikely that I would be. I met my wife going to a convention to do an Empire Strikes Back presentation. She was there attending the convention. So that certainly had an effect. You know, all of my career in one way or another leads off of what I did at Lucasfilm and Star Wars, in how it shaped me and how it informed me, in connections I made and friendships I made. Now, some of that came off of who I was already, the person I was, my knowledge of marketing from studying social psychology, my involvement with science fiction and comics fandom. I mean, so each grew from the other. But certainly I owe Star Wars a great debt in Star Wars fandom. And I've always been grateful and I've always been involved. I still have friends at Lucasfilm. I mean, there's nobody at Lucasfilm now who was at Lucasfilm when I was there, but there are people at Lucasfilm I have met since.
Right.
I'm still in contact and I still often get invited to things by them. They occasionally ask me for things. When the Empire Strikes Back 800 numbers, when I found the old tapes for that and posted them on Facebook and they went viral to the point of Entertainment Weekly doing a story on them in like 2019 after however many years that is. I guess that's 40 years. Lucasfilm Archives contacted me and asked me for copies of the tapes because they didn't have any.
Right.
And I've been asked by publishing if they could quote from my book in books they were doing. So that's, you know, very pleasing and it's nice to be appreciated.
Absolutely. Did you want to ask him about, what is it that you have, Dave? You went out and got it about, is it the book or the pamphlet or what?
Wait, what? I'm not sure what you're going. I was going to bring up the fact that when we were talking about the holiday special, a movie had just come out. And I got a copy of it earlier this year, and I rewatched it, and I was like, hey, that's the guy we're talking to, A Disturbance in the Force.
Yes, A Disturbance in the Force. It's a really good documentary about the making of the Star Wars Holiday Special.
And it's fair, too, because it puts it in a context that, like, I think a lot of people don't – because people just see it now, and they don't – again – I'm old enough to remember what the 1970s were like, and TV from the 1970s, and my mother was a huge Carol Burnett fan. And
they approached it very fairly. They had seen it. They were aware of what it was like, but they didn't come to it with the attitude of, oh, what is this terrible, awful thing? Let's make fun of it.
Yeah.
They did a serious, straightforward documentary about how it came to be, what it was supposed to be, what it was like compared to other holiday specials of the period, and how it ended up being what it ended up being. And it's very fair. And yeah, they interviewed me for it, and I'm in it. There are a few clips of me in it.
Yeah, there's more than a few.
There's more.
I think what Mike was asking, was mentioning, reminding me, is so part of my Star Wars journey going way, way back is when I was six, we were on a family vacation in Florida, and I was staying with my cousins, and they were all talking about this movie that they had gone to see, and it was amazing, and they're going to go see it again and again and again and again. And, I mean, spoiler alert, it was Star Wars, and they didn't take me. But they had a book. They had, like, a little book that the theater gave away, right?
Yep.
And I looked it up the weird thing is I looked it up on eBay, and I've got a copy now. I've got a copy of a book, but it's completely different than what I remember. I remember it being very small because I was six, and it was small and black and white. And this thing is like, it's big. It's big, and it's flat, and it's color. Were there different little pamphlets that were given to the theaters?
There were a couple different things. I was not involved with this, but there were some what I'd call screening brochures that you could get at theaters.
Mm-hmm.
And they were small, maybe 6 inches by 8 inches or something like that.
Yeah, that's what I've got. Yeah.
And then there was another thing that's shaped more like a calendar, the size of a wall calendar, which is something but 20th Century Fox sent out to theater owners, to exhibitors, to encourage them to book Star Wars. Wasn't available to the public. It was strictly an exhibitor item, an exhibitor brochure. And it had lots of color photos and things like that. And like I say, it was shaped like a wall calendar. Yeah. And we did a similar, but shaped differently, exhibitor kit for Empire Strikes Back that was in a black cardboard box with a black Darth Vader on it. One was, you know, the box was shiny and the Darth Vader was matte, I think. And inside were two wide format. Inside was a black with a pewter Darth Vader medallion on it. And inside that were two wide format color McQuarrie paintings.
Oh, wow.
Not originals, of course, but print.
Yeah.
Two of Ralph's paintings from Empire. And that was the exhibitor kit for Empire Strikes Back. But the one for Star Wars was, like I say, like a wall calendar format.
Yeah. My memory just must be wrong, man, because I remember it being like a little tiny book, and it was black and white. And it looked weird, and I was like, can I go with you guys? And they're like, the classic line is, I said, can I go with you guys? And they said, no, you wouldn't like it. Like, if you could see the wall behind me, it is nothing but Star Wars.
Yeah.
Like at one point you mentioned the poster that was included with the album, you know, the soundtrack album had like that poster.
The John Berkey poster.
Yeah, I got that at a toy show just a couple weeks ago. Like got it back. I had one as a kid and it was torn up to pieces on my wall.
Yeah, that's a great poster.
Yeah, I love it. Like Star Wars basically defined my life too. So
yeah,
I always think it's funny that
John Berkey's a terrific artist, did a lot of science fiction. And I walked into the Lucasfilm office one morning and there were like a dozen small roughs by John Berkey of Star Wars art. And I so wanted to walk out with them.
Well, anyway, enough of the Star Wars nonsense. Talk to us about your THX-1138 cosplay.
Well, I was a huge THX fan. I saw it in the theater when it came out. What year was that? I forget now. But whatever year that was, it must have been 74. I was going to the WesterCon, the Western Area Science Fiction Convention, which that year was up in San Francisco. And I talked a few of my friends into doing a THX group. So two of us did THX-like characters, you know, the bald. We didn't shave our heads. We had really terrible bald skull caps and we've got costumes made up. And then we had three guys as chrome robots, which is basically black pants, a black, you know, turtleneck. We got blank face masks and we chromatized them and, you know, motorcycle helmets. And then we got these giant dowels and painted them black. And so we did a whole group and we came on stage and we acted out a scene from THX and we won a prize. And I mean, today it looks kind of, you know, cheap and awful, but it looked much better in 1974.
Yeah, absolutely. That's awesome.
But when I say I love THX, I really love THX. It's actually the only time I went to a costume competition at a convention was to do that costume.
Yeah. Very awesome. Very awesome. All right, folks, we're going to have a couple more questions with Craig, but right now we got to go to a quick ad break. You're going to hear some podcast ads from other shows here on GCRN, as well as other podcasts that we promote, and we'll be right back right after this.
So let's say you're looking for a podcast of your favorite 80s comic books, G.I. Joe, Transformers, Ninja Turtles, He-Man, etc. Where are you going to go to find us?
Welcome to Star Joe's Podcast. I'm your host, Ryan.
And I'm Chuck. That's right, everybody. We're the Star Joes. We host a podcast called Star Joe's Podcast, where we talk about your favorite comic books, your favorite toys of all the 80s properties.
Star Wars, G.I. Joe, Transformers, Mask, Thundercats, Voltron, you name it, we cover it. If it's in the 80s, we'll cover it at some point.
Yeah, so what you want to do to find us, you can go to iTunes, you can go to www.starjoes.com.
And remember, the Force will be with you.
Because knowing us is half the battle.
Hello, geeks and geekettes. Looking for a podcast that covers a vast array of topics? Then check out Altered Geek Unleashed, where we discuss our thoughts on this week's geeky news, tech, gaming, television shows, movies, cartoons, comics, and more. So, get altered, get geeky with the Altered Geeks, every Friday on the GeekCast Radio Network.
Do you like the Transformers?
Yes.
Do you like the Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles?
Cowabunga!
Do you like IDW Comics?
And comic book podcasts?
Then come check out Ninjas and Bots. Each week, we look at an issue of Transformers
or Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles from their IDW Comics incarnation. We drop episodes every Saturday morning.
Just like the cartoons we loved as a kid. The show can be found on your favorite podcatcher and at johnreadscomics.com.
See you then.
All right, folks, we are back here on this GCR interviews episode for Geekcast Radio and Studio 2009. We've got two more questions for Mr. Miller before we let him go. What advice would you give to aspiring film professionals or writers based on your experiences?
Advice. Everything, obviously different people have different amounts of experience, but it always comes back to having good material, good samples. I mean, if you're writing television, you absolutely have to have samples of the types of things you want to show. No one's going to hire you just because you say you're a writer. They're going to want to read stuff. And feature writers, obviously, you get hired based on things you've written. So it's always the work that counts the most. But it's get out there, meet people. I used to teach. I was a part-time teacher at the Art Institute of California, teaching screenwriting and animation writing. And I always told people, meet people. Everyone in the industry you meet, they've got their job because there was this guy or there was this woman who they met who was doing this, and they told them to show up over here. So I, go to festivals, go to conventions, meet and talk to people, meet other aspiring filmmakers, because one of you is going to get a job first and can open some doors for meetings for the rest of you. It doesn't have to be meet people who've been doing it for 40 years. If you're all just starting out, one of you is going to get a better job and you're going to help each other, move forward. That's the way this industry works. Your work has to prove itself for your career to continue and advance. But to get in the door, it's so often just the luck of having met someone who can tell you there's an opening over here. But that luck is by having gone out to meet people. Yeah. You're causing that luck. You're causing yourself to be able to encounter the luck. It's having the samples to show. So you were lucky to have the samples to show. You build luck. It doesn't just happen. Not if you really want a career. You have to make it happen. You have to make it happen by doing the work. And part of the work is getting out there and meeting people. And it's hard when you're not in a film or television making center. Obviously New York and LA, it's a lot easier to get into the industry. Yeah. But there's stuff being done pretty much everywhere. So you just have to find it and connect with it, or maybe start up a monthly gathering at a bar for aspiring writers or aspiring filmmakers. Be your own group meetings.
Absolutely.
Well, I think Mike gave me this question because he knows that I am very antisocial online.
I gave you the question because I didn't want to be the only voice talking for the next 10 minutes.
But where can the fans interact with you online?
The easiest way to find me is on Facebook. I'm on Facebook as both Craig Miller and Star Wars Memories. I know a lot of younger, it's mostly us older guys who are still on Facebook,
yeah,
or older people. But hey, I'm older. I'm still on Facebook. I'm still on Twitter or X. I don't post much, but I can be reached there, I think. I have a Blue Sky account, which I'm also not on very often, but should be able to reach me through there. But Facebook's the easiest way to do it.
Very cool. Very cool. All right, folks.
Of course, can get copies of my books, Star Wars Memories and More Movie Memories, through Amazon, or it's actually also available online through Barnes & Noble and apparently Walmart. And they contact me directly. I'll sell autographed copies.
Very cool. Very cool. Yes, folks, go read the book, Star Wars Memories, More Movie Memories. They are both amazing reads. And anyone who's a Star Wars or movie fan definitely would want to be reading these. Any upcoming projects before I run through the closing that you are allowed to talk about, or are you kind of done doing current day stuff?
Well, I'm still doing current day stuff when someone hires me. I mean, I don't work for a studio. I'm a freelance writer.
Right.
So, like I say, I'm waiting to see if we're really going to start this Japanese project. It's based on a Japanese steampunk novel, which is really cool that they want me to adapt into an animated screenplay. We just have to get the final details and commencement money to show up, and then I'll start on that. And I'm open to other projects if people want to hire a writer to develop or script shows. Other than that, the only places I know I'm going to be appearing right now is I'll be at a small science fiction convention called LostCon here in LA in a couple of weeks. It's Thanksgiving weekend. And next year I'll be at WonderCon in Anaheim and the San Diego Comic-Con. I haven't booked out anything else for next year yet.
Yes, folks, by the time you're hearing this, it'll be the middle of December, so you'll miss out on the Thanksgiving convention. But you can catch him next year at San Diego and, what did you say? WonderCon. Yeah, good old WonderCon. Gotta love WonderCon.
And, hey, I'm open to other conventions if you want to have me as a guest.
Absolutely.
I do slideshows and talks and sell books.
Very cool, very cool. All right, folks, coming up here in the dark side of December, and yes, that's what I've termed the entire 31 days of these podcasts that I'm doing. Dave and I will be back. We will be talking about Star Wars, the holiday special, and the Lego holiday special, the new Lego version that Disney put out. So that's the next episode. After that, Dave and I will be doing the music for Star Wars, the sequel trilogy, episodes 7, 8, and 9. And then, folks, we begin a 9-day mystery extravaganza because we're going to go through every single episode, all 9 episodes of season 1 of Columbo. So that's what's coming up here on the podcast. Dave, any final thoughts before I run the closing line?
I just want to thank Mr. Miller for taking time out of his day to come and talk with us. And I really like the books. I actually, like, when we first announced we were going to do this, I actually bought them because I don't like reading on a computer screen, and I really enjoy them. And I have a friend who's really looking forward to the second book because he's a huge Muppet guy. So,
well, great. Thank you so much.
Speaking of that, the books, just out of curiosity, any plans to do audiobook versions of them?
Well, I'd love to do an audiobook. When I wrote the first book, we started people convinced me, even though I don't think I have a voice for radio, people convinced me I should do the audiobook because the book is written in my voice and it's me telling stories. Yeah. And we started recording it. And then my wife developed a disease that had her in the hospital for 3 months. She's fine now.
Okay.
But I really wasn't able to.
Delayed things. Yeah, obviously.
I wasn't able to record, and by which time, you know, the book came out, COVID happened, and we just never recorded the audiobook. And, you know, maybe we should still. Maybe there would be an interest in it.
I guarantee you there would be. Because that was the first, when you first sent us the email, and I was like, oh, cool. Immediately went to Audible. Crap. They're not on Audible. So, yes, I mean, it might just be me, but I'm telling you, there would be interest. And, yes, when you are someone who is writing your story and telling your story, it's best if it comes from the author, whether you have a good voice for radio or not. And you do, actually. So,
well, I won't debate with you whether or not I have a good voice. But yes, I would be doing the recording, and maybe we'll still do it. I have a friend who runs the Hollywood Sound Museum and has offered to provide the equipment needed. So maybe we'll still do it.
Very cool. Very cool. We would definitely be listening to those in the future, folks, if they are done. All right. As Dave said, I echo the same sentiments. I'd like to thank Mr. Miller for taking the time to join with us here in this latest Geekcast Radio Presents interview. I've already told you folks what's coming up next here inside Studio 2009. As far as Geekcast Radio, I don't know. Steve and I will be doing something over there. I have no clue. So for now, you'll hear us back in the studio soon.